fit. This is so good.
Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, where is it? I'm going to play it. There it is.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it. Well, I and on the air.
That was created by Rachel and Michael of Trinity House Entertainment.inc, an inspirational site, and they did it just for MJ Network. MJ Network stands for my sister, who I lost, Marsha Joyce, who got me started on this book review and radio show. And we are live on the air with the author of yesterday's news, R.G. Belsky, and this is really exciting. I'm going to talk about a very, very serious issue: what happens when children go missing. Families are devastated and they don't know. Lives can be ruined. Good morning. How are you? I am so excited that you are here.
Well, hi, friend. Yeah, I'm glad to be here. It's a great, it's a great morning. It's spring in New York City. I've got a new book out, and I'm talking to you. So, what could be better?
I don't know, but the sun is shining out here too, up in Upper Westchester, and I'm like, finally, no rain, and this is so cool. So,
right. The
issue of children being kidnapped and gone missing is present in this everyday news. So why did you focus on this, and as a reporter and commentator, how did this help you write this novel?
Well, it's not – when you write a book, you don't necessarily, plan out what you're going to do or how. You know, you have – something comes to your mind, and then it kind of develops. And that's kind of what happened with yesterday's news. Mm-hmm. Yesterday's news is, basically, for the listeners out there, is a story about a legendary missing child cold case in New York City and about a reporter who becomes obsessed with finding out the answers to it. And there's a couple things that motivated me to write this book. First, I've covered a lot of murders in real life because I've been a journalist for a long time, and I've written about a lot of murders as a mystery author. But this is a bit different. I mean, there are some murders in there, but this is really about a missing child. And I was always struck first by the enormity of the tragedy of missing people cases, but certainly of missing children. There's a book by a reporter down in Miami who covered crime, Edna Buchanan. I use her quote in the beginning of the book. And she talks about how a missing person case is even worse than a murder for the victims. Because in a murder, you know what happened. You know the person is dead. In a missing person's case, you don't know. You can go your whole life and never know if that person is dead or alive. And when it's a child, it becomes even, more horrifying. And the other thing is, I go back quite a ways in New York journalism, and I was around as a young journalist in 1979 when probably the most famous missing child case of all time happened here in New York City, which was the Eaton Patz case. And, that was a little six-year-old boy who disappeared off the streets of Soho. And for years afterward, there were hopes and false leads that he was still alive, and no one ever knew the answer. And, in that one, fairly recently, a few years ago, a suspect was finally convicted of the murder. So, Eaton Patz's family was able to get some closure. I mean, they knew the child was dead. He wasn't grown up and living somewhere. And they also knew that justice had been done. So my book is about a case where there is no such closure, where a child disappears and no one ever knows the answers until my reporter, Claire Carlson, decides to go looking for them. And, the answers aren't necessarily what you would expect them to be.
No, they're not, and I'm not going to give away what the answers are either. But, I've read, and everybody knows, a couple of thousand books, seriously, since I started doing this in 2009. And everybody knows I can read like 10 or 15 within 2 weeks. It's scary sometimes. But when you're reporting something like this and the media reports it, every reporter reports it in their own different way and their own take on it. So what are the steps to take when someone reports a missing child or an adult? How do you report that without, you know, making it worse on the family that's going through this?
Well, you know, I mean, the idea of making it worse on the family or worse on the victims is true in almost any in any murder case too, because you know, the media does do things that, you know, like you basically will call up the family and ask them for reaction to the tragedy, you know, that's where sometimes people don't like the media, but that also is the media's job. So that gets into a tricky area. But, you know, missing, as you probably know, you know, missing person cases in general are harder to deal with for people to take seriously, authorities and things, than a violent crime that we know about. Because, you know, if it's an adult, there's the whole thing. We don't know for sure the person's missing. If someone's husband or wife or somebody goes missing or your friend goes missing, maybe they just decided to go away. Maybe they're, you know, mad. You know, you don't know, and people didn't show up a week or two later. So there's always the thing, like with a missing person, that a missing person has to be gone for so long. Now, with a child, it's completely different, especially with a very young child. If it's a teenager, I mean, obviously the kid can run away or something, but you know, in my case, it's an 11-year-old girl, and it's pretty clear, you know, that something has happened to her. But but even so, you know, there's that moment when you're not 100% sure that it's really as bad as what you think it is. I mean, I remember on the Eaton Patz case, we had a reporter who found, the first person we found out about it was like walking down the street and saw these cops, said, oh, there's a little kid that's missing. And she called the story into the New York Post desk where I worked at the time. You know, and at first it's hard to take it seriously. I mean, it was kind of like, oh, well, they'll probably find him. He just wandered off. But obviously with a child, you know, as time goes on. And in my book, basically, it's a little girl who gets on a school bus and then doesn't show up in the classroom at school. And, you know, certainly by, you know, at that point, you know, by the end of the day, when they start reaching out to the parents and nobody knows where the child is, they realize that, you know, that something really bad has happened.
Well, as an educator, I know that if a child, you know, it's funny, in my class was missing for a day or two, or even someone that's had 100% attendance, I probably would have called in and said, is he sick or something like that. A lot of people don't realize that. So we've got...
And the other thing...
Go on.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, the other thing that the book talks about, that I really try and take a look at in this book, as you know, quite heavily, is apart from the tragedy of the missing child, is the tragedy of what it does to the family. And, you know, it's the same with murder victim stuff, but even so, even more so with a little child. And, you know, in my book, and this is not a spoiler because, you know, I talk about this very early on the book, it tears apart the family, and the husband and wife who are married and with this lovely little girl, they drift apart, their lives are destroyed, the wife, the mother, becomes obsessed with the case, the husband kind of wants to, you know, start his life over again, but I just think, I've always, like, I don't know, fascinated is the word, because it's a terrible thing, but it you know, as a writer, I wanted to explore that, you know, the crime just doesn't affect the victim. It affects the people around and how it affects all their lives, too. And, again, as you know from the book, a great deal of yesterday's news is about that aspect of the crime.
I know. And I kept getting angry at the husband, too, some of the things that he did. So you can know I read this. And then I read it again, and I'm saying, oh, my God, this could really happen. This has happened. So we have Claire Carlson, and I take it she's one of your main characters, and I'm sure you're going to bring her back so that I can read more. And we have the Lucy Devlin child that's missing. Why all of a sudden did they want to bring this up, and what about interviewing the mother? She appeared, like, disjointed and a little odd at times. I wasn't quite sure if she was even plugged in on the same wavelength as the rest of the world.
Right. Well, this, you know, the setup for the book is, and, you know, Claire Carlson is the main character, and, yeah, and yes, she will be returning next year, which we can talk about later. But Claire Carlson is a TV journalist, and she's actually the news director of a big TV station. But the backstory on this, and which I think makes it much more personal, is so 15 years ago, she was a young newspaper reporter in New York City who was covering the original disappearance of Lucy Devlin when it happened 15 years earlier. She became a media superstar by doing this because she got all these exclusives, and eventually her coverage is so extraordinary, she even wins a Pulitzer Prize for this coverage of the missing child. And so it makes her career. Now, 15 years later, she's a big TV news executive, and this story is coming back. And the reason it's come back is the mother, and we find out, again, fairly early in the book, the mother has found out that she's got terminal cancer and she's only got a few months to live. So she's desperate to find out some answers about what happened to Lucy before she dies. And she's got some new leads and some new evidence. Nobody's really sure, you know, how substantial it is, but she comes to Claire and wants to do an interview with Claire on TV and make this appeal to anybody who knows anything about her daughter to come forward. So that's kind of the ticking clock, or whatever they say on the plot, which is the mother is dying 15 years later, so she wants to know some answers before she dies, and Claire gets drawn into this. And you know, Claire has very mixed feelings about this, because even though this story made Claire a big media star, Claire is, you know, it was 15 years ago, and it was in her past, and she's got all sorts of reasons for not wanting to go back there, some of which aren't clear to the reader until the book, you know, develops. But you see, as I say, Claire is a little bit of a, you know, the term these days is an unreliable narrator. It came sort of became popular with Gone Girl and The Girl on the Train, which is the narrator isn't, she's not lying about anything. She's telling the truth. She's just not telling you the whole truth. And that sort of becomes parceled out in smaller bits as the story goes on.
Yeah, I know. And this season, it was an interesting narrator, very interesting. And I've read so many books of different types of narrator, you know, the first person, second, third, omniscient narrator. And I read that sort of divorces themselves from the story and tells it in their own way. So we've got Elliot Grayson, and why do we hear him, and why is he so powerful in so many
well,
circles?
Well, one of the things that Claire discovers as she starts pursuing the new evidence in the disappearance is that the new evidence is basically that the little girl might have been seen at a motorcycle convention with members of a motorcycle gang like a couple days after she disappeared 15 years ago. So the members of this motorcycle gang obviously become suspects, but at the same time, there's a reference to an Elliot that she might have been with, and then Elliot Grayson turns out to be a rising star in politics. He's a federal prosecutor now, and but he's running for the U.S. Senate. But he was a member of a motorcycle gang when he was a young kid, and we find that out. So she begins to suspect that maybe he has something in his past. So there's this juxtaposition of like a motorcycle gang in New York City and one of the most powerful politicians in New York City, and so she keeps asking questions and looking into both of them, and, you know, she keeps finding out things that don't make sense to her and raise more questions. And we begin to realize that all these people in the book, the motorcycle people plus the Elliot Grayson character, seem to know something about Lucy Devlin or know more about the story than they're revealing. And so that's that's the story that Claire keeps pursuing. And there's a romantic interest, because at some point Claire is somebody who she's been married three times. She's had trouble having stability in her personal life because she's so crazy, obsessed with her job, so she finds herself becoming attracted to the Elliot Grayson character, even though she's not sure if he's a good guy or a bad guy, and he's attracted to her. So we have some sort of sexual tension in there too, which mm-hmm. may or may not be objective journalism, but you know, in terms of a novel, I think it adds to the color of the book.
It added to a very interesting scene, and that's what I'll say about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, when a child goes missing and is found and not found, it impacts on the family. And what happens when, I don't want to say the whole question out loud because I think I'm going to cross out part of it. What happens when Claire learns where these children might be? What happens when she learns more about it? And why
right.
is Elliot at the center?
Right. Well, you know, it starts out as a case involving Lucy Devlin as a missing child, and it, you know, as the book goes on, it grows, and she begins finding out stuff that there may be other missing children involved, which may or may not be connected to the Lucy Devlin disappearance, but there's new evidence of other children's bodies and other children's abductions, and again, wherever she goes. You know, Elliot Grayson is sort of in the picture. I mean, not for necessarily a bad reason, but his name keeps popping up everywhere. Mm. So when there's a discovery of a number of other missing children's bodies that are found, none of them who are Lucy Devlin, but then she discovers that this had happened a few years earlier, and that the law enforcement official who was in charge of the digging up of the bodies turns out to be Elliot Grayson too. So there's all these coincidences that he keeps popping up, and you know, they always say, you know, don't believe in coincidence. And so Claire begins to wonder, you know, why he's everywhere in the story. And again, you know, as she digs more and more, she keeps finding more and more evidence that he's got some kind of link to all this that he has never revealed to anybody.
Mm, it got mysterious, and I wasn't sure if I liked him, but it doesn't matter.
I had somebody who read the book recently, just did a review of it on Goodreads, who said, and I take this as a compliment because they liked the book, and they said, mm-hmm. I don't know if I like Claire, you know, like she's fascinating, but
yeah.
I want to shake her
yeah.
sometimes, you know, because.
Me too.
But you know, I think, you know, as a writer, and this is my 11th book, and I did a series with a reporter, Gil Malloy, before this. You know, one of the things you want to do is make the character interesting. And one of the things that will make a character not interesting is to make them – I mean, you want the character on some level to be likable, but they can't be the nicest person in the world because that could be boring. I was lucky enough to get an author blurb quote on this from Reed Farrell Coleman, who's one of the top Mr. Editors around today. I love his stuff. He writes the Jesse Stone series, and he writes – you know, wrote what – he writes his own other novels too. So he was talking about writing Jesse Stone, and you know, we all Jesse Stone, the Robert B. Parker character. You know, we see him on TV movies. He's Tom Selleck. You know, and Reed was saying how he's a difficult character to write because he's so good. I mean, he's good looking. You think Tom Selleck. He's tough. He's honest. You know, and you know, like. But in the end, you know, that can be boring. So it's like you have to bring faults to him. So on the other hand, Jesse Stone is an alcoholic. He's got a broken marriage. He had a baseball career that was ended cut short by an injury. So I try and do this with Claire too. You know, like I want people to like her, but more than that, I want people to want to be around her or hear what she has to say or be fascinated by her. And I think she's basically likable, but I think we've proven with some recent books that characters don't have to be likable to be great characters. I mean, you know, Gone Girl, I think, is the classic example. There's not one likable character in that book, but, you know, it's a great read, and it was a great success. But everybody in there is, you know, in the end is pretty unpleasant. And the girl on the train is a little bit like that, too, you know. So I think of Claire like that. She's got a lot of faults, but, you know, in the end, she's somebody, you know, you kind of want to be around.
Yeah, I do. I read Gone Girl, and that's all I'll say about that. I didn't read
I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a I didn't like the movie as much,
different.
But I thought the book was and it broke you know, like it broke all the rules, you know.
Yeah, it did, especially the ending and stuff. So,
yeah.
Let's talk about Claire. Yeah, she did get me annoyed at times. I wanted to say to her, "Open eyes and see what's in front of you." You know, what can I say? Yeah.
Well, I give her a best friend named Janet Wood, and Janet Wood is kind of the voice of sanity for her personal life. She's a lawyer, and so she's the one who has these conversations with Claire, where Janet says some of the same things you just said, like open your eyes and, you know, and do this, you know. But I think the good thing about Claire, I think, is she knows that her personal life is screwed up. You know, there's a scene early on in the book, and I think you and I talked about it briefly in one of our emails before the thing, which I sort of thought captures her, where when she's first trying to find out if there's anything new about Lucy Devlin, she one of her ex-husbands is a cop who, you know, would know something because he's a homicide cop, but she knows she shouldn't call him. And she talks about how, you know, it's the stupidest thing in the world to call him. And, of course, she picks up the phone and calls him. She's had a few drinks. It's the middle of the night. And, you know, it goes very badly. And not only does he not have any information from her, but he reveals to her that he's living with somebody else and that that person is pregnant with their child. And, you know, that's the moment, you know, and she gets very sad about it. And her friend says, well, do you want to be back with him? No. Do you want to have a child with him? No. But it makes her realize kind of on some level how empty her personal life is at the expense of what she has put into her professional life.
She's a lot like me in some senses, because if I want to know something, it doesn't matter. I'm going to find out. I won't call, you know, like she did an ex-person. But if I want to know something, the answer to a question, I'm gonna just go until I find what I have to find out, because that's just me. So she's a little persistent. So I had to like that about her. She doesn't give up on anything.
Well, like a lot of journalists are like that. And again, you know, this idea. One of the things I try and capture with this, and to be honest, with almost all the journalistic characters I've done in my books, is this thing I see so much as working as a journalist here in New York City, which is so many people, and men as well as women both, who, you know, just are so obsessed, so involved in the news every day, getting the scoop, getting the front page of the story, that their personal life suffers. So their marriages or their personal relationships or whatever, and they're not necessarily in good shape personally, but their career is the only thing that they're dealing with, and it may not be a good thing, but that's the way it is. And Claire is sort of falls in that category.
Well, let's tell us about her boss. He got me annoyed too, by the way. You see,
her
because
boss,
she's a good reporter, and he didn't think that her story was good enough to be on the air.
Well,
so she interviews Grayson for the first time. At the end of her interview, the question sets him off, and she has to delete the answers, which, of course, some of us would never do. And what did she do wrong? And being the news director, Danny and Brett, they wanted to do the story, but they let her do it, and that was not too smart, was it?
Right. Well, yeah, there's a couple questions in there. So the first thing is, I would disagree with you about the news director, because I actually write him, I think, as a fairly sympathetic character who has to put up with a lot of stuff from Claire. And she, and I can't remember if it's in this book or in the next book that I've just done for Ocean View about Claire, but I mean, she makes comments about him basically that he's, you know, in terms of being a TV executive, like he's about the best you can be. And then, you know, at one point I know she says something like, in one of them, something like, which is a little like, you know, that he's basically a nice guy when it comes to TV executives. She's like, it was just kind of basically saying like Charles Manson is a nice guy when it comes to something. Because, you know,
that's
like
right.
TV executives are so bad, but that in the scheme of things, you know, he's good. And he basically had created her career in TV because the backstory here is, so she's a big star reporter at a newspaper in New York as a younger woman. The newspaper goes out of business, as many newspapers sadly do today. So she winds up getting a job as a TV correspondent, and she's horrible on TV because all the things that we like or don't like about her don't come across on TV. So, you know, as she explains, I think in the beginning of the book, that, you know, they told her, you know, you're unlikable on TV. You come across as too intense, too grating, you know. You don't work on TV. And so the news director, whose name is Jack Farron, says, but maybe we can give you a job as a manager running the other correspondents, you know, which, as she points out, really doesn't make a lot of sense. Like, why should I be running the people if I can't do it myself? But they give her the job, and she moves up in the ranks, and now she's the news director. So she gets to tell all these other people what she wants to do, even though she, on TV, you know, it was kind of a disaster. So this story comes along, and the reason she winds up doing it on TV is because the mother of Lucy Devlin will only talk to her on the air. So she wants to do an on-the-air interview, and they want the interview, the station does. But because she has a relationship with Claire, the mother only will do it with Claire. So at that point, Claire does the interview, and that gets her into the story. At that point, she decides, I want to keep working the story myself. But even so, you know, she's not great on the air, and in fact, there's a lot of jokes about that when she talks about, you know, she goes to a news meeting and with all her reporters and says, "Well, who's going to do it?" And she said, "I'm going to do it myself." And they're, "You really?" You know, and you know, don't you remember? And she's basically, well, I wasn't that bad, you know. So that's a running theme through the whole thing. And then the other thing is her having to manage all the egos and personalities at a TV station. And, you know, we're all familiar with this a bit from seeing TV and reading about TV stars and you know, and watching shows like, you know, Murphy Brown and all that over the years. But, you know, I spent the last six years of my life working in the TV business at NBC. I was on the digital side, but I worked at NBC local stations and then NBC News. And you know, a lot of that is true. There's tremendous egos, much more than you see, you know, at a newspaper. So she's got to, like, play the two anchor people up against each other. She's got certain people there who are really good reporters, other people there who look good on camera but aren't terribly bright, so she has to make sure that the script is right for them. So, you know, I try and tell this stuff, but in an interesting way. I don't want to be a nuts and bolts industry behind the TV thing, but it's part of the story, which is how she has to deal with all the personalities at a TV station at the same time she's doing the story.
You're right. I know, because I watch different channels in the morning. I keep turning them off because after a while I get annoyed. And,
right.
Some of the anchors, you know, look like they work well together, and some of them look like they want to overstep the other one. So
right.
These two reporters, Danny and Brett, both of them want to be in the limelight. So they each have to take turns, which sounds ridiculous, who's going to be first and who's going to be second. I mean, it's
right.
Like, yeah. And then we've got the one that she calls the Barbie girl.
Right. Well, I've always been amazed, and you know, is basically a non-television person. I've always been amazed in watching shows like, yeah, how – you know, it takes two people to read, you know, so one will do one sentence, then the other will pick it up. You know, you have the co-anchors, and they each are doing a line, and you think about it, you don't really need it. You can have one person do it all, but that's the way it's all set up. So I sort of play off that a little bit that, you know, at one point they get into an argument over, you know, at the very beginning, you know, where they say, "Hi, this is Brett, this is Danny," with the, you know, with the news, Danny is the woman, D-A-N-I, you know, well, why can't I go first? And then, you know, so Claire has to broker a compromise where one of them signs on each day, and then at the end, the other one leads the sign off at the end, you know, and it's just crazy stuff like that. And, yeah, you know, the Barbie girls, she's got a couple, people look at TV now and they'll say, "Oh, that person's only on because they're attractive," and some of that is true. And some of the people who are attractive are very good. Now, Claire is attractive. I mean, I make it clear in the book she's attractive, but she's a real news person. And there's other people at the station who are real news people too. But but, you know, she's got a couple people there who are really there for the looks, and those are the people she has to cover for. You know, she has to make sure they don't mispronounce. I mean, you know, it's all we all draw it to some degree, I think, from, you know, Ted Knight on the old Mary Tyler Moore Show, you know, which was the bumbling anchorman. He was hilarious, you know, because he really didn't know anything, and Murray Slaughter wrote everything, but Ted made all the money and went on the air, and that's, you know, went on to, you know, you can go on to Anchorman, you know, with Will Ferrell, and all these shows that kind of will make fun of people, you know, like what people who are on the air do, but some of it is true. Now, you know, there are many great people on TV. I mean, I worked with at NBC, and like you know, Chuck Scarborough, who's been doing the news for like about 40 years on NBC. I mean, he's like a totally professional newsman. Gabe Pressman, you know, was a great newsman at NBC when I was there. So there's some really good journalists. But when you're writing a book, it's more kind of fun to write about people with less shortcomings, you know.
I agree, because I watch the news in the morning on a lot of different channels, and I'm finding that a lot of it is about social media, or they have stories that are really not related to the news. And I'm like, this is a serious news story, and why are you, like, standing there drinking coffee and laughing? And it bothers me, I guess.
Well, you know, a lot of it is, you know, you're doing it for the ratings. And right, yeah. and the whole media business, I mean, newspapers and TV both, have changed so much in the past. Oh, I want to say 10 years, but certainly over the past 5 years. And I've had to deal with this in the writing because, you know, I wrote a book in my – I wrote a series about a reporter named Gil Malloy for Atriots. They did one in 2014, and then I did three more books in the next succeeding years before I did this Claire Carlson book. And in the first one in 2014 called The Kennedy Connection, my character is a pretty traditional reporter. He files stories, and they appear in the newspaper the next day and, you know, basic stuff. By the end – he's got to be tweeting the story the minute it happens. He's got to be live streaming from the scene because you can't ignore all the things that have gone on in the media. And the same thing that happens with Claire. She has to deal with things like, you know, the station's app and redesigning that and things like that, things that you never would have, you know, in the old days we just would go to payphones and put coins in. And now it's a lot harder. You got to keep up with all this stuff, which was, I always thought one of the brilliance, and she was brilliant in many ways, of Sue Grafton was when, you know, all her mysteries, all the alphabet mysteries, you know, they were all set in the 1980s. So she didn't have to deal with any of it. You know, she could still use payphones, and people weren't on the internet, and people read newspapers. Sometimes that's a little simpler, but I write all my books in current day, so I have to take into account, you know, what's going on out there.
Yeah, I know, and that's probably why. You see, I should tell everybody that this book came to me in September, and I said it's coming out May 1st. I think I better get started reading it now. And I won't tell you how many New York Times authors, seriously, I put on the back burner, because I sat down and I said, okay, I'm going to read this now. And then I said, okay, I'm going to find him on Facebook and get an interview.
Right,
and my husband looked at me and said, you really going to do that? I go, yeah, I really am. And I was glad I did, because this book is really noteworthy. So we've got Claire, and she's relentless, and she won't stop looking into the Devlin disappearance.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite scene is when she faces off with Grayson, and that was good. And also,
is this after the mean in the bedroom? In the bedroom?
Yeah, that was so good. That was so good. Oh my God, that was so good. We won't tell anybody, but that was really good.
No, but let's just say there is, again, there's sexual tension, and it kind of explodes into a confrontation, and it involves to some degree, you know, the story too, and so there's a lot of parts to that, and because to some degree, what Claire is doing there is journalistically or politically incorrect, because you know, and she actually talks to her boss about it, but she's mixing her personal life with her professional. She's having involvement with somebody, this Elliot Grayson, who she's looking into for a story, you know, a lot of that shouldn't happen in real life, but you know, one of the things I find I've always found interesting about writing books, at least the ones I do, is that you can't make them too realistic. I mean, on one hand, you want it to be, oh, wow, this guy's got a real take on what really happens in a newsroom, and I think I do, which I think is something that I can bring to a book that somebody else, like, that somebody else can't. But I was at a conference over the weekend down in Washington, Malice Domestic, and we were talking about this. A lot of it's unrealistic because no reporter, no journalist, you know, works exactly like Claire does. I mean, there's always something exciting happening in her life. The truth of the matter is, you know, the life of a lot of reporters can be kind of boring. And I've always been struck by a story that Raymond Chandler that was told, and his great character Philip Marlowe, that somebody wrote or said to Chandler, you know, the whole thing about Philip Marlowe is he's not really very realistic. I mean, no real detective gets knocked over the head every day and meets a beautiful blonde dame and all this stuff. And Chandler responded, no, you're absolutely right. He's totally unrealistic. But if I wrote about what a real detective did, you know, reading divorce papers all day, absolutely nobody would read me. So, I really think about that when I'm writing. A lot of the stuff that Claire does, you know, a real reporter probably wouldn't do, like sleeping with the guy that she's investing or thinking about it. Although it has happened, but for a book, I mean, you know, it's like, it's the same thing when you go to a movie, you watch a TV show. I mean, you want all that emotional involvement. You want the twists. And as we said, we not only want to root for the character, but there want to be moments saying like, what is she doing? You know, like, why? I don't know if you watch Homeland, but I do that with, you know, the Claire Danes character on Homeland. Like, I love her, but, you know, she sleeps with everybody. And you're like, what the hell are you doing? You know, like, but keep watching.
I watch a lot of things. My cousin's got me stuck on Criminal Minds and Law and Order. I have no idea why, but this is his favorite program. But before I forget, the one and only, and you know him, and we all love him, John Land, Thursday. And I am so honored. I am doing the very first interview for the new book, Date with Murder. Jessica Fletcher takes front stage, and he wrote it, and it's really good.
Oh, wow. Wow. So this is, he's taken over the Jessica Fletcher series.
Uh-huh, and it's better than ever, let me tell you. And Jessica is right there with Jeff Metzger. And we have Monday, somebody else we all know and love, Brian Friedman, Alter Ego. And we've got Abuse and Discretion on the 10th. That's about sexting, and it's very interesting. Now we've got another one from Partners in Crime, Dead Air, on the 14th. And we got the one and only, you know her, she's this interesting character. I met her once, Nancy Allen, Wolf in the Woods. Then we have an author from England, Look for You, on the 24th. And we've got on the 29th, Preordained. And on the 24th, we got Lying, Cheating, and Sometimes Murder. And on the 31st, we've got Burn One Down, which is a very interesting book. Preordained was scary. And a panel show with one of your favorite people, Charles Salzberg, Alan Topol, Bruce Coffin, and John Lansing. We're going to talk about open endings and anything else that comes to my mind as I'm talking. You never know.
Right. Well, that sounds pretty exciting. Yeah.
Well, feel free to join us. This is going to be wild.
I
know. It's going to be crazy.
Yeah. Keep me in mind. I did, going back to the Jessica Fletcher thing that you talked about, I actually got to know the late Donald Bain pretty well. Who wrote that series for so long, and he actually read one of my early books and gave me a great quote, which I used. And I met him a few times. Really nice man. Him and his wife, co-writer Renee Paley Bain, who also tragically died within a year of each other. But their stories about writing that character were hilarious because, you know, writing Jessica Fletcher, you have all these rules of what she can do and what she can't do.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, You know, I mean, it was like, it's not even like no sex. I mean, like, she can't even, like, barely touch a man, you know. She certainly can't, you know. And he would talk about, you know, what the rules were for Jessica Fletcher. So it'll be interesting to see how the series continues. But, you know, look, we all know and love her from the TV show, and that's still, those books are still great.
Well, wait till you read this one. He fits into the mode of it, but he's got his own take on it. And, you know, the technology from when he first wrote it, when they first wrote it, to now is different. So Sheriff Metzger has, you know, some extra tools that he could use to help solve whatever it is that happened. And I'm not going to say what happened. And, yes, John did put Donald Bain's name on the cover.
I think they wrote about 25 or he wrote I think about 25 or 30 of them. You know, the whole industry of people who continue to write something after someone else dies. I mean, again, I think Robert B. Parker is the and I'm all for this if the books are good, and a lot of them are. And you know, Robert B. Parker, of course, had two of my favorite series, which is Jesse Stone and of course Spencer. And Ace Atkins took over Spencer, and my friend Reed Farrell Coleman took over Jesse Stone. And it's interesting, you know, when Reed Farrell Coleman talks about making the character his own, even though basically. He said the only rule that they asked him to follow was to write short chapters, because Robert Parker was always known for writing quick, short chapters, which I like.
Yeah.
And but other than that, you know, he could take the character wherever he wanted. And I think that can be really interesting. And I you know, I was a huge Robert B. Parker fan, but I know, too, with the Spencer books, the Ace Atkins books, they might even be better Spencer than Spencer was in some of the books toward the end, you know, because he was writing so much. So it's really interesting when someone can take over something that somebody's done, and in this case, like Donald Bain wrote so many of the Jessica Fletchers, and keep it going, and at the same time maybe change it a bit, and, you know, and make it just a little bit different.
It is a little bit different, but it's fantastic, I have to say. It's seriously fantastic. Because, first of all, I love Caitlin Strong. And for those of you that haven't looked at my site, I'm on Facebook, I've listed the top authors for the month of May, and I'm sure that somebody I'm speaking to is part of that. I don't know what possessed me to do this, but I decided that I was going to honor a whole bunch of authors, and I'm going to add some more for the month of May for people that write about real-life incidents. So I have to add a few more people, and I don't know why I'm doing it. I did it. And June is going to be strong characters and strong male and female characters. So we've got Joey Minnelli. When she interviews him, what problems does that cause for her? It makes
this gets a little tricky, because this, you know, you find out some stuff as the book goes on. But let's just say that not all missing children stay missing forever. I guess that would be the way to say it. And when she goes missing for somebody, and this again is not Lucy Devlin, but she goes looking for somebody who is missing and been presumed dead for years and years. As the kind of little search for Lucy Devlin expands into other cases, she's startled to find out that one of these kids is alive, and he's grown up, and he's now an adult, because it's 15 years later. So he disappears when he was like 12. He's like in his late 20s now. And, you know, the thing about it is that she has this, like we all do, I think we have this image that all these kids are these adorable little kids and they're going to grow up to be adorable people, and he isn't. I mean, she actually finds him in prison, and she realizes that, you know, it was almost like his life is preordained no matter what. I mean, he was with a real terrible family, and he had run away, and the family, his father and mother were horrible people, but even though he got away and wound up with a different family, he wound up sort of the same way his mother and father did, which is a criminal, and he's in prison. And so there's a lot of just, you know, coming to grips with not everything is perfect, and not all these little kids who disappear are, our angels, and, you know, this is all part of the big story of Lucy Devlin. And again, this is not directly related to what she finds out about Lucy Devlin, but as she's looking for her, she starts looking into all these other cases and finding threads and connections between all of them.
Well, here's my long speech over here. All of the children that have gone missing have one link, or mainly abused verbally, physically, or sexually by somebody. Why wasn't anything done, and why didn't anybody report it? And why would the police, as an educator, I know that if, and I've had it happen, a student would walk in and say, this is what was done to me by a person. And as an educator, I had no choice, otherwise I would be in trouble, to report it. So why didn't anybody realize that this was happening, and why didn't anybody report it?
Well, I think it in the cases that I do, when I talk about this pretty extensively in the book, it's not apparent for a lot of reasons, and part of it is because there's different kinds of families. In the case we just talked about, Joey Minnelli, I mean he lives with a creepy family, a father and mother don't really care about him, and they beat him, and they don't take any care of him, and all this kind of stuff. And Claire actually says to him, why didn't you go to someone like a counselor at your school? There's a direct question. And he's like, what would they have done? They would have contacted my parents. They wouldn't have done anything. And basically, like, I would have gone home and gotten beaten up more. I mean, whether or not that's true, that's the way he saw it. I mean, he didn't see going to telling anybody. So he never told anybody. He'd say, oh, I fell down or something like that. But then there are other cases that she looks into, where she's looking into these other missing child, that you would never suspect. And you know, there's one family she goes to in the town of Princeton. And I actually live in Princeton. I have a house in Princeton, so I kind of know the beauty of the great college town. And this seems to be an idyllic family with a idyllic, you know, they go to church, they have this beautiful house, they have this, you know, money and everything, and everything seems wonderful. But then when you peel away the layers on that, you say, well, it isn't so wonderful. You know, there were things going on in this house that shouldn't have been going on. So I think it's just, you know, it's not always apparent, you know, number one, because it's a wonderful family and nobody could imagine that this was going on there. And also, you know, the kids, like, they don't know what to do for a lot of reasons. They don't tell anybody because they're afraid, or they don't trust anybody or whatever, or they're just, you know. And the other thing I think I talk about a little there too, and it's the same thing you have seen a lot of things where people, I think children, they think on some level it's their fault, you know. There's that great scene. There's that great scene in Good Will Hunting at the end between Matt Damon and Robin Williams, where he keeps saying, it wasn't your fault, and then the Matt Damon character breaks down. And I think there's a lot of that involving child abuse, and I think there's a lot of that, too, where, you know, if you're a young child, you're 8, 9 years old, and your parents are doing things to you, it's like, well, you know, I must be bad. Why would they do that? Because they're your parents. So I think you don't understand it at that point. So I try and deal with, I mean, look, it's not a heavy-duty book in that sense. I'm not out there to completely, you know, explain everything about these things or psychological, but a lot of this stuff Claire comes in contact with as the book goes on. And I think there's no easy answers to it, either in the book or in real life. And I think, you know, so, yeah, if somebody could go and say, this happened to me, but, you know, and then, I mean, I think a lot of it you could even – I don't know if this is a good comparison, but to some degree you could allude to, like, the Me Too stuff that goes on now. You have women who come forward years afterwards and talk about things that happened, and people say, well, why didn't you do it when it happened? And there's all sorts of emotional reasons why they didn't. And it's not even the simple one of, oh, I didn't want to ruin my career. A lot of it just has to do with, you know, able to deal with it and to be able to come forward and say to somebody what happened. And I think it's even worse for a child, because a child, if the child's 8 years old, they have no no background or basis of logic and how to deal with it.
It's scary, I know. I had a student that came up to me right before I retired, and she said, this is what my aunt did. And I reported it, and lo and behold, the mother came in. I thought she was going to kill me. And
right.
I said, you need to calm down and you need to listen, to what your daughter was saying. And when they finally, I said, I will apologize if I'm wrong, but I wasn't. And she couldn't believe that it was her own sister that was doing this to her child, watching her.
Yeah.
So I said, you know what? I'd rather be, you know, wrong than find out years later that I did that I didn't do anything. So when seeing Anne in the hospital, Claire feels the pain in her heart for her and for the missing child. Patrick Devlin doesn't even acknowledge her. Why? He doesn't even want to know, even after she's gone. He doesn't even care. I wanted to hit him.
Well, as
seriously.
I said, I think we said at the beginning of the conversation, I think, you know, I try and really take a look at the impact on a family. And in this case, we look at a lot of families, but the Lucy Devlin family. And, you know, they split up and they get divorced, but they go in two different ways. And Anne Devlin becomes obsessed more and more with Lucy and the case, and basically spends her whole life trying, you know, looking around, trying to deal with whatever she has to deal with on it. So she pretty much like loses her job, loses her husband, and throws away her life, obsessed with this moment when her daughter was taken away from her. Patrick Devlin responds in a different way. He responds, you know, and on some way it seems cruel and unfeeling, but I think it's understandable. He talks about it at one point to Claire. He can't wallow in this all his life. He believes, you know, Lucy's gone. He can't spend the rest of his life doing this. He and his wife have grown apart. So he moves on with his life. He moves to a different city, Boston. He gets married. He has two new kids. He has a happy family. So on some level, you know, he does not want to get involved in this. He doesn't want to get involved in this anymore because he doesn't want to have to deal with his past. He's tried to shut that part of his life out so he can deal with his current life. And that may not be a sympathetic thing, but I think you can understand why someone do it. So it's two different ways that people deal with it. And then, of course, you know, without getting into detail, and you know, in my book, nothing is as simple as it seems, and neither Anne nor Patrick are quite what they necessarily seem when you first find out what their lives have become. Because, you know, and nothing is simple like that. So there's a lot of things going on with both of them as the book goes on.
So how would this case and the final truth reveal about Claire's life? That ending got me, let me tell you. But we're not going to talk about that. That ending was absolutely perfect. I'm saying no one is going to figure this one out. So as a result of what she did in this particular case, because we have about 5 more minutes, is she going to fight harder for missing children? Is she going to keep going it? And when someone breaks the law for a good reason, is that okay?
Well, that's another, again, number one, this book is about, you know, missing children, and that's the topic. I mean, the next book is sort of about, you know, is about a different kinds of crime that's going on in 2019. Because, you know, when I first wrote my book about the Kennedy, the Kennedy connection, and it was all about how the Kennedy assassination, the clues there might have something to do with the present-day murders, and my reporter goes back and does it. And, you know, it's a part of an interesting concept, I think, but then a lot of people afterward, they like to say, and they said, oh, you got another book coming out. Is he going to keep trying to solve the Kennedy assassination? I'm like, no, because, you know, where are you going to go with it? I mean, you know, like eventually you move on. So, I mean, Claire is not like going to make missing children her thing in future books. That's really the topic of this book. I mean, that's not to say she wouldn't care, but the next book is about something, you know, really completely different. But this thing about do you break the law, that's really one of the one of the crucial aspects of this book that I tried to deal with, which is you always try and, you know, tell the truth, do the right thing, follow the rules of journalism, follow the law, and do all these things. But then sometimes there comes a point where you have to decide, you know, is it better for me to do the right thing here, to do the right thing, or to follow the rules and follow the law? And that's the big decision, you know, as you know from the book, that Claire eventually has to come to grips with, because She talks a lot in the book. She's one of these people, like a lot of people I know, very important to her, her integrity as a journalist, that she's completely truthful as a journalist. But there comes a point where she may have to not be follow all those things in order to make sure that the right thing happens. And that's like the moral decision to make, and it's a decision that Claire herself isn't even sure of, and you can, you know, you can tell from what she says and what she does that she agonizes over it, and in the end what she does bothers her on many levels. But you know, I just think this is true of a lot of things in life. Like, it's just, I try to do this thing that none of this is simple. You know, if we all had a set of rules to follow and we just followed them, life would be very simple. But you know, it becomes more complex than that. And I think Claire decides that she needs to do the right thing, even if it doesn't seem quite as obvious that this might be the right thing.
Okay, so we have two more final questions. First of all, what's the next book about, briefly?
Yeah, the next book is...
Where can we learn more about
the,
you and your work?
Right, the next book will be out in 2019, May, it'll be a year from like now. And okay. The working title right now is called The Cinderella Murders, and that's about homeless woman. It's about a homeless woman who's found murdered on the streets of New York City. Nobody cares about her, and nobody covers the news, really, but Claire starts doing it, and it basically opens up into a case involving all sorts of prominent people. And it's really all about how one person's insignificant murder can become incredibly significant. And in terms of myself, well, my website is www.rgbelsky.com. And, you know, there's all this stuff about my books and also my background. And, you know, real quickly on my background for this is that I was a top editor at the New York Post, involved in things like, you know, Headless Body and Topless Bar and all the incredible tabloid headlines that went on there. I didn't write that, but I was there. It involved when it happened. I was at Star Magazine. We covered a lot of celebrity stuff. I was was managing editor of the New York Daily News here in New York for a number of years, and most recently I've been at NBC, where I was managing editor of NBC News, working with the nightly news and other people. So, you know, I really try and bring a lot of this news background into the book, so that you know, when people read the books, hopefully they like them. But even if they don't, they can't say, "Well, he doesn't know anything about journalism." Yeah, I think I can say I do, and hopefully I can make it interesting to people too.
It was, well, before I forget, because she's going to be very upset if I don't do this. Today is May 1st, and my little princess niece Penelope turned 10 today. And if anybody looks on Facebook, her aunt wrote her a poem, because it wouldn't be me if I didn't write something. So Penelope, you're 10, you're double digits, and you know, you're getting there, kid. You're catching up to me slowly. And yeah, she is.
Once you hit 10, it's all downhill, right?
That's it. You're going to be a teenager soon, and she's a really sweet kid, and your aunt is going to bring you what you want for your birthday, more books, because she's my book partner. She loves the book,
happy birthday, Penelope.
Well, she'll be thrilled. So the final question is, yesterday's news, basically, is today's news, right?
Right.
Until it's solved. That was probably the last thing that I wrote in the book review. For those of you that haven't read this book, what are you waiting for? It came out today. And before Amazon runs out, I would suggest that you get a couple of million comps. By the way, Mother's Day is in 2 weeks. And, to me, the best present in the world is a book. So for those of you that didn't catch the words to my opening song, it says, "Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a book. Travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see, a chance to escape reality. Open your minds and your hearts, gain new knowledge, get a new fresh start. MJ Network will beat you air." And we were just live on the air. And that was made by Rachel and Michael of Trinity House Entertainment.inc for me, because they love me. And they think that this show is special. And hopefully when they write some new songs, they'll be on again. But I want to thank you so much. I'm looking forward to meeting you. Again,
great, Fran.
I'll see you at
Thriller Fest, Fran. Right? Yes.
You certainly will. Everybody,
okay.
Have a great day. It's beautiful outside. Don't waste the weather. And bye.
Thank you. Hello, Fran. You on? Good. Thanks. Okay.